Hello, my name is Dr. Gary Collins. I'm a clinical psychologist and professor of counseling at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Deerfield, Illinois. This is a tape about interpersonal relations, getting along with people. This tape is not meant to replace a counselor, to answer all your questions, or to solve your problems for you. It is intended instead as a supplement to counseling, an added plus that your counselor would like you to hear and discuss during a later counseling session. It has been discovered in the past that listening to tapes can be very helpful to people. So listen as we spend some time looking at the issue of interpersonal relations. Not long ago, I was invited to speak at a conference, and a man called me and asked if I could talk about the biggest problem facing Christians today. I was interested to know what he thought the biggest problem was, and he suggested that this major problem is that we have trouble getting along with each other. Adam and Eve had some tensions in the Garden of Eden, as we all know, and we've had problems getting along with fellow human beings ever since. It happens internationally, of course, when countries are at odds with other countries and can't get along. It happens in the law courts every day when people try to settle their disputes in front of their lawyers and the judges. Certainly it happens in churches when there is disagreement and jealousy and criticism and gossip. And I think if we'd be honest, we'd have to admit that it happens in most of our lives. It isn't easy to get along with people. The Apostle Paul alluded to this many years ago in the book of Romans, chapter 12, verse 18. He wrote, "As far as it depends on you, live in peace with everyone." It's interesting that this verse starts with four little words that sometimes we forget about. If it is possible, so far as it depends on you, live in peace with everybody. Sometimes, it seems, getting along with other people is not possible. And even if it's possible, it may not be easy. So how do we get along with people? What can you do if you have a problem with your boss, with your neighbor, with your kids, with your spouse, with your parents? How can we get along better with people? Well, let me make some suggestions that have helped others, suggestions that I think can also help you. Number one, start with the basics. It's easy to get impatient with others. It's so easy to get annoyed. It's easy to say the wrong thing and to be misunderstood. So if we're going to get along with other people, I suggest that we need divine help. In our house, we have two daughters. They're in their 20s now. But when they were growing up, we had differences of opinion at times, like every family does. And my wife and I prayed often. We asked God to give us wisdom about what to say. We ask for wisdom about how to say it. And we ask for wisdom about when to deal with sensitive issues. I believe God hears prayers like this, and He gives us wisdom. Prayer is one of the basics of a good relationship. And if you are having difficulty getting along with some other person, I suggest you make this a matter of prayer to start. But there is a second basic. It's a basic that concerns our relationship with Jesus Christ. When the Apostle Paul was writing to the Corinthian church, he talked about the fact that many of these people were Christians. Paul calls them brothers. They believed in Jesus Christ as Lord. They believed that He was able to forgive sins. But for some reason, their Christianity hadn't made very much of a difference. They were acting like worldly people, like non-believers. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 3, Paul writes, "You are still worldly. For since there is jealousy and quarreling among you, are you not worldly? Are you not acting like mere men?" When people are casual Christians, they are much more inclined to be involved with quarrels and arguing and impatience. They're much more likely to have difficulty getting along with each other. Several years later, Paul wrote to the Corinthian church, and he described the lifestyle of non-believers who don't take their Christianity seriously. He said, "These people sometimes are characterized by hatred and jealousy and rage and selfish ambition and dissension and factions and envy." We see a lot of that, don't we? But he said the Christian, one who commits his or her life to Christ, one who invites the Holy Spirit to come into one's life and completely control our lives, that person is characterized by what Paul calls the fruit of the Spirit. You can read about this in Galatians chapter 5, beginning with verse 22. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. If we live by the Spirit, says Paul, we are not going to become conceited or provoking and envying each other. We have these characteristics which enable us to get along better. Now, I'm not naive enough to assume that if you or I are committed Christians, all our problems are going to disappear. But I do believe that when we ask the Holy Spirit to cleanse us from sin, to fill us and guide us, to bring about these characteristics in our lives, then we begin to show some of the love and patience and kindness and self-control and other characteristics which Paul talks about. And these characteristics help us to have better interpersonal relationships. So how do we get along with people? Well, the starting place is with prayer and with a growing relationship with Jesus Christ. That's looking at the basics. Let's move secondly to having a look at ourselves. Ask yourself, could some of my biases be creating problems? Could some of my attitudes be the problems? Could my fears, my insecurities, my rigidities, even my prejudices be creating some of the problems that I might be having? When husbands and wives have difficulties, we all know that the natural response is to blame the problem on the other guy. But many times we have to stop and say, maybe it's me that is causing the problem. Jesus once talked about this when he said, before you are concerned about picking faults with other people, look to see if there is something in your own life that might be getting in the way. In most conflicts, I think there is fault on both sides. And before we start blaming other people, maybe it's helpful to look at ourselves. Maybe I can give you an example. It's a simple example, maybe even a silly example, but I suspect you might be able to relate to it. Teenagers and parents, as we all know, often have disagreements. They disagree over things like hours and clothes styles and tastes and music and values and all that sort of stuff. One day several years ago, when our kids were younger, I came into the house and listened to this incredible noise that was coming from one of their rooms, and I told them to turn down that racket. Then I began to think about it, and I thought, I have never really listened to their music. Do I have prejudices against teenagers' type of music? Prejudices that are maybe going to make things worse? Had I jumped to the conclusion that all of this music was bad, was likely to lead kids astray, that all of it had dirty lyrics? Had I jumped to some conclusions that were wrong? Was I rigid? Was my attitude creating part of the problem? Well, I swallowed my pride and asked the kids if I could listen to some of their music. Much of this happened in the car when we were going from place to place, and some of my fears were confirmed, but I discovered that many of my attitudes were wrong. And when I listened to their music, it wasn't what I had thought it was. Many of my attitudes changed. This avoided a lot more conflict in our house and built better interpersonal relations and better communications with my kids, because I had the sense at that point to stop and have a look at myself and to see what I might be doing to create the problem. Of course, lots of times we forget to do this. But if we can remember that the solution doesn't come in having a fight, it doesn't come in avoiding the issues, it doesn't come in getting into a big squabble. If you are having difficulty getting along with somebody else, a good point for bringing about peace is to ask yourself, if you have some prejudices, if you need to change, are you at least open to change? This brings me to my third suggestion. First, we talked about starting with the basics, prayer and our relationship with Christ. Secondly, we talked about looking at ourselves. Thirdly, I suggest if we're going to get along with people, we need to try to understand the other person's point of view. You may not agree with the other person's perspective. You may not like the other person's perspective. But if you try to understand that person's perspective, you get along a lot better. Let's suppose that you and your boss have a difference of opinion about salary. He or she thinks that you need to be getting less than you think you ought to be getting. So you have different points of view. Maybe a way to solve the problem is to try to understand your boss's point of view. Ask the boss to explain why he or she has come up with the figure they've come up with. try to let them, that person, justify what they're coming from. This helps you to understand where the boss is coming from. Maybe he or she has got very good reasons for making the proposal or the figure that he came at. Maybe this will open the door for him to hear you. If you tell the boss what you think, then you have better communication. Not long ago, I was reading about a mother whose 7-year-old boy came home crying. He'd been in a fight with another neighborhood kid, and apparently they'd been in fights many times before. And the mother in the past had jumped on the kid and told him he wasn't supposed to fight, but this time she decided to try to understand her 7-year-old's point of view. So before she reacted and got into a big squabble with her kid and telling him he shouldn't fight, as she usually did, instead of doing that, she stopped and listened to him. I spent a moment or two trying to find out why he got in the fight, she said. He began to pour out a tale of woe about this bully in the neighborhood who kept picking on him. He told me, she said, how he tried so hard to avoid fights, but the kid kept picking on him, and eventually he was getting in the fights all the time, even though he was trying not to do so. The mother said, I jumped to the conclusion that my son was creating the problem. Instead, I began to recognize that he was trying to avoid it. Then I became convinced that he was trying to stay out of fights and was having difficulty doing it. The mother was able to help her son and to understand her son and to have better communication with her son because she had taken the time to try and see his point of view. You may not agree with the point of view of another person. If you are having a difficulty with your boss, the boss's position may not be the position that you agree with, but at least if you can try and understand, and the boss can try to understand you, at least when you have difficulties, if you work at understanding the other person's point of view, then you are able to have better communication and to get along better. This brings us to my fourth suggestion on the tape. We start with the basics, we look at ourselves, we try to understand the other person's point of view, and then number four, we focus on communication. I'm sure you have heard that lack of communication is one of the biggest problems that married couples face. One of the biggest reasons why people don't get along with each other is that they can't communicate. And I would suggest to you that if we really want to get along with other people, it is important that we learn to communicate and communicate well. And on the remainder of this side of the tape, I would like to suggest to you some guidelines for good communication. I've got 12 of them that I'd like to share with you. Each of these, I think, will enable you to communicate better and to get along with other people better. Suggestion number one, try to speak kindly, politely, softly, respectfully. It doesn't help very much to yell or nag or whine or gripe or talk down to other people. Those kinds of attitudes just bring about more tension. If you can speak gently, I think that would help. I remember one time talking to a man who said, whenever I'm involved in any kind of negotiations, if he was in his business, he said, I try to never raise my voice. I try to speak kindly and politely all the time, and we get along a lot better. Oh, sometimes we lose it. We all know this. But if we can try to make it a habit of speaking kindly and politely and softly, we're going to have better communication. Suggestion number two, try to listen carefully. Listening, of course, is the basis of a lot of good communication. So often we want to talk and say what we're thinking. Sometimes we want to preach to other people, lecture at our kids, interrupt other people, ask a lot of questions to try and create more tension, when really we need to be listening. Now, there's value in asking questions sometimes, but if you ask questions, make sure that they're sincere questions and that you want to hear out the other person as he or she answers. If you can get into the practice of listening, you're going to get along a whole lot better. I think that's what happened with my kids when we were debating about the rock music. I listened to where they were coming from and we communicated better. Thirdly, let me suggest that you try not to put down other people. Sometimes people will get into disagreements and they'll resort to ridicule, sarcasm, name-calling. other kinds of comments that are almost certain to bring about an argument. It's better to use what some counselors have called I statements, not E-Y-E, but the letter I. Tell people how you feel. I feel frustrated. I feel that we are not communicated. I am uncomfortable right now about our relationship. And when you make those statements, starting a sentence with I, you are at least saying how you feel. It's pretty hard for a person to argue with that. That's not putting other people down. It's telling them where you're coming from and communicating in a gracious, kindly way. Number four, try to decide what is important to emphasize and overlook the rest. I know of some families, and perhaps you do too, who have a lot of conflict because it seems that they criticize each other over everything. Maybe it's important for us to decide what is pressing and what needs to be discussed and what we can overlook. Several years ago, one of my kids decided that the most stylish way to do her hair was to have her hair in two colors. And she had it dark on the bottom and light on the top. Now that somehow went against my middle age sensitivity. But I began to think, in all of life, is there anything less important than how she had her hair done at that point? I could overlook that. Let's deal with more significant issues than the color of her hair. And so she went around with two color hair for a while, got over it after a while, and went on to other things. And we didn't have a fight over it because I chose to overlook the hair so we could focus our attention on more important things. Think about places where you have disagreements. Are there some things that you could overlook so you can focus your attention more on the things that are of importance? My fifth suggestion for good communication is that you avoid loaded words. Let me give you two examples. Try not to say, "you never," or "you always." Think of the mother who goes into her teenager's room and says, "When are you going to clean up this mess? You never clean up your room." As soon as she says "you never," that's going to provoke a fight. The kid may remember one time 3 years ago when he cleaned up his room. It's not fair to say "you never." In fact, he's likely to say back, "you always nag." And then this leads to a big squabble. Let me suggest that you avoid terms like "you never" or "you always," because those terms very frequently lead to conflict. Suggestion number six. Try to express your point of view or your position clearly and concisely. Let people know what you are thinking, what is going on in your own mind. Vagueness in your communication just brings about confusion and difficulties. Several years ago when we got married, I was struggling with some things. I think they were in my career, and I didn't want my wife to have to worry about this, so I decided not to tell her. I didn't want to burden her with problems with my work. And she began to wonder what was wrong, and she taught me an important lesson at that point. She said, "Gary, I might not like what you are thinking, but I'd rather know what is bothering you than to have to try and guess." And I have tried, and she has tried in the years since, to at least let each other know what we are thinking, to express ourselves clearly and concisely. That brings better communication and prevents a lot of misunderstanding. It's an openness that I think is helpful in any kind of attempt to communicate well. Number seven, if you are misunderstood, try to state your position clearly again. The same applies if you misunderstand somebody else. Ask that person to state his or her opinion clearly again. Several years ago, a counselor suggested that if you really get into difficulties here, you might want to try what has been sort of called an echo approach. Let's say it's a husband or wife trying to communicate. The husband makes a statement, and before the wife reacts, she states what the husband said over again to make sure she understood. So the husband says something, the wife repeats what he says, then she responds. The husband, in turn, repeats what the wife said, then he responds, and back and forth. This may seem artificial, and I suppose it is, but it makes sure that the husband and wife, each of them, are listening to the other before they respond. Too often when we have arguments or disagreements, we don't listen. Instead, we are so anxious to present our own view that we don't hear what the other person is saying. If you are misunderstood, try to state your position clearly again. If the other person is misunderstood, ask that person to state their position clearly again. We're not going to have good communication if we don't understand each other. Suggestion number 8, try to avoid double messages. A double message is where your words say one thing, but your actions say something different. Suppose a busy father says to his kids, "I love you, kids. You are very important to me." Those are his words. But he never has time to be with the kids, never has time to read them a bedtime story, never has time to tuck them in, never has time to go to the Little League game. The kids get a double message. He is saying one thing, and his actions are showing something different. Sadly, actions often speak louder than words. And if we are going to be effective in communicating and getting along, try to have your actions and your words say the same thing. Avoid the double message. Suggestion number 9, stick to the topic. We probably can all think about disagreements that we've had, but start out with some one issue, and before long we're arguing about all kinds of things. I think we do this a lot. Husbands and wives do it frequently. Let's go back. Say over the last 3 months, something happens and makes the husband angry. He doesn't say anything, but he keeps that in the back of his mind. A couple of days later, something else happens that annoys him. Doesn't say anything, keeps it in the back of his mind. And over a period of weeks, he builds up all these petty annoyances. Then one day, some little thing happens that sets him off, and he explodes and pulls out all the ammunition that's been hitting in the back of his mind. The wife has also been accumulating all this ammunition, and before long they're arguing about everything, so much so they can't even remember what got them started in the first place. They're not sticking to the topic. They're not dealing with one thing at a time. They are accumulating their gripes and getting them ready for the next battle. It is better instead to try to discuss areas of conflict when they arise, one at a time, one issue at a time. Otherwise, we build up massive conflicts, and we don't communicate well, and we just have more and more tensions. If we can stick to the topic and deal with disagreements when they come up, we're going to communicate better. Suggestion number 10, don't be afraid of humor. I am not suggesting that you should be sarcastic or biting or putting other people down. That kind of humor is only going to create problems. But if you can see some humor in a difficult situation, if you can learn to laugh at a difficult situation in a healthy way, this is going to relieve tension and bring about better communication. Number 11, try to focus on interests and not on positions. This is something I learned on the basis of some research that has been done at Harvard University. They suggest that if two people each have a position, they dig in their heels and fight and have conflict. If, on the other hand, they try to find common interests, they'll get along better. Let me give you another example from my own family, if I might. One of my kids came home not long ago, a daughter, who told me that she decided she was going to get a motorcycle. My position was, daughters do not tear around the city in a motorcycle. Her position was, I want to have a motorcycle. We have two positions and a great deal of potential for mother-father conflict. She agreed that she would wear a helmet. That didn't help me at all. I didn't think it was good for her to be running around with a motorcycle. But we could have had all kinds of struggle over this position, but I backed off and we began together to talk about what did she really want. And it occurred to us that what she really wanted was safe, affordable transportation. She had a friend who had a motorcycle. He was willing to sell it to her for a relatively good price. She could see this as a way of solving a transportation problem. The issue that we were arguing about or had could have argued about was the motorcycle. And we could have each dug in our heels with a position for or against the motorcycle. But when we backed off and looked not at our positions, but at our interests, her interest was to have good, safe transportation, and that was my interest too. When we discovered that we both had the same real interest at heart, then we were able to work together and find a solution that we could both accept. In this case, a good used car. that wouldn't be too expensive, but would do the job and be safer than riding around on a motorcycle. My 12th and final suggestion for good communication and good interpersonal relations is that you be open to a variety of possibilities. Sometimes when we have difficulties, we decide there must be only one solution. But maybe there are other solutions that we haven't even thought about. Maybe we should approach our disagreements with an open mind. Somebody suggested that it helps if we try to find a fair standard, a fair procedure, or a fair mediator. Let me try and explain. First, we try to find a fair standard. Let's go back to that issue of you disagreeing with your boss about salary. Instead of digging your heels in and arguing back and forth about how much you are going to be paid, maybe you should look at other people in the community to see what they are paid, people who have the same training that you do, the same experience that you do, people who are working in the same business as your boss's business. And when you look at an outside criteria like that, then maybe you can come up with a better relationship and a better conclusion to your disagreement about salary. Or suppose you are haggling with somebody about the price of a car. Instead of debating and arguing about the price, try to find an objective way to settle a dispute. See how much the car is worth. Look in the blue book. Look at ads in the newspaper. Maybe look at some other people who are trying to sell cars like this car you want to buy, and see how much cars like this are selling for. It's a more objective standard and helps to deal with difficulty. Sometimes if we find an objective, fair standard, we can do better. But sometimes we try to find a fair procedure. Remember the old example of kids cutting a cake? We used to do this in our house all the time. There would be a piece of cake left, and my sister and I would argue over it, so one of us would get to cut the cake, and the other one would get to choose the first piece. What we were doing was trying to find a procedure that we would both agree on. I read not long ago that divorce lawyers sometimes will suggest to a couple, why don't you together decide what would be a fair arrangement for the parent to visit the kids, and before we decide who is going to have control over the kids, if you both decide what is fair in terms of visitation rights, then we can move from there. What they are trying to do is arrive at a procedure that they both agree on. In your state or province or wherever you live, there probably are lotteries. Let's suppose everybody put their money in a lottery this week, and then we decided there was going to be a debate as to who was going to get what out of a lottery. People were going to argue in law courts, or they were going to write letters to try and decide who got what out of the lottery. There would, of course, be chaos. Instead, everybody agrees. If we are going to be involved in the lottery, everybody puts their name or their number or however they do it into the hat, and somebody pulls out the number, and the person who wins gets all of the money. The results may not be equal, but everybody has an equal chance. It is a procedure that everybody accepts. And sometimes you may even agree to draw lots or to flip a coin. That may be the best way to solve the problem, but you try to find a fair procedure. If this doesn't work, try to find a fair mediator. Sometimes you stay at odds. All of these principles we've talked about on this tape, you try and they don't work. But sometimes it can help to find a mediator. Some person who is willing to side. Some person that you and the other individual agree will be a mediator and make a decision. If you agree beforehand, what that person says you will both abide by, and you both agree on who the mediator is, then you can often reach a conclusion. Now, all of what we said on this tape is going to take practice. All of it may take work. You may want to go back and listen to this side of the tape again and again and remind yourself of some of these things that have been suggested. But let me suggest that you can get along better with people. It takes effort, but it can be done. But sometimes, just sometimes, despite our best efforts, we still can't agree. And we may have to accept the fact that there are going to be times when we can't get along. If this happens, if you reach an impasse like this, be sure that you are not the problem. Earlier on this side of the tape, I referred to Romans chapter 12, when the Apostle Paul talked about living in peace. If it is possible, and so far as it depends on you. But let me read that whole section of Romans chapter 12. It's a good way to end this side of the tape. It's a good summary of our interpersonal relationships. It's a good summary of some of the things that I've been trying to suggest on this tape on ways that we can get along with one another. Romans chapter 12, verse 11, never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Verse 16, live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everybody. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone.
When it happened several years ago, I found it annoying and ridiculous. Now when I think about it, the whole thing seems incredible, almost crazy. I had finished my courses in graduate school and had moved to the West Coast, where I was to begin a program of practical training and counseling. The work was rigorous, but there still was time for church. And soon I found myself involved in the active college and career group of a large congregation. Before long, I was elected president of the group and watched with real satisfaction as our numbers grew and our outreach expanded. Then it happened. I was told confidentially that some established members of the church had concluded that I was a communist agent sent from the Midwest to attract a following of Christian young people who would rise up against their country when it came time for the revolution. The fact that I had grown up in Canada made me even more suspect in the opinion of the critics, who never confronted me directly. I was not just a dangerous revolutionary masquerading as a Christian, they thought. I was a foreign spy. I was also dumbfounded. Nothing could have been further from the truth, and it was amazing that my vigorous church activities could have been misinterpreted like this. When I went to the pastor and offered to leave, he smiled kindly and admitted that he had heard from the critics. "But forget what they think," he said. "Keep on doing what you believe God wants you to do." Then he added a comment that I had never forgotten. "Whenever you are trying to do something worthwhile, you can expect to be criticized, often unjustly." The Bible would support this conclusion. In both the Old and New Testaments, people were criticized, sometimes unfairly. Jesus, for example, was called a glutton, a drunkard, a friend of sinners, and even a colleague of the devil. On several occasions, he was accused of breaking religious laws, and when he went to weep at the grave of Lazarus, some of the neighbors complained because Jesus hadn't come soon enough to prevent his friend from dying. On one occasion, the Lord almost seemed to throw up his hands in despair and proclaim that there was no way to avoid criticism. You can see this in Matthew chapter 11, verses 18 to 19. I mention all of this because sometimes when we're having difficulty getting along with people, at the core of much of this difficulty is criticism. Sooner or later, we discover that people are criticizing us, and nobody likes this. Nobody likes criticism, even when it is supposed to be constructive. There are several reasons for this. First, criticism hurts, especially when the criticism isn't accurate or based on good facts. It really bothered me to have those church members believing and spreading false rumors. Their criticism was not based on facts, and they lacked the courtesy to identify themselves and to check out their conclusions with me. Recently, there appeared a cartoon in which two little kids were discussing presidential elections. "I wouldn't want to be elected president," one boy exclaimed. "I get blamed for enough things as it is." Probably every public figure feels like that. I bet many pastors feel like that at times, and so do the rest of us who are ordinary individuals. It isn't pleasant to be criticized. Why, then, don't we just ignore the criticism and not let it bother us? Well, for most of us, it is difficult, if not impossible, because criticism attacks our self-esteem. First, criticism hurts. Secondly, it attacks our self-esteem. Criticism implies that we are unimportant, deceptive, wrong, or worthless. And our critics often make use of just enough accurate information to make their charges plausible. Soon we begin to wonder if the critic might at least be partially right, and this begins to erode our self-confidence. In addition, sometimes criticism reminds us of an unpleasant past. People who were constantly criticized as children often become adults who are super sensitive to the opinions of others. The criticized child feels helpless and put down, and when he or she reaches adulthood, it is difficult to shake off these feelings. New criticism reminds us of the past and continually opens up old wounds which we would prefer to have heal and disappear. But it isn't always possible to wipe out the past, and this brings us to another reason why we don't like to be criticized. Criticism often leaves us defenseless. Not long ago, a book appeared in which the author criticized me, using such words as deplorable and ignorant to describe my work. As you might expect, this attack left me angry, and I felt helpless. How could I defend myself? How could I correct the writer's conclusions, which, from my perspective, were wrong? How could I present my side of the issue to the book readers, or to a writer who was unavailable and apparently unwilling to budge from his published evaluation of me? Most of us feel a real sense of frustration and helplessness whenever we are criticized. We may want to defend ourselves or to express our point of view, but it isn't easy to put our thoughts into words, and sometimes we don't even know who our critics are. As a result, we feel that somebody has dumped garbage on us, and there is very little that we can do to avoid the stench. But there are some things that we can do when our interpersonal tensions come along because of criticisms. We can handle criticism by admitting that it exists, by acknowledging that it hurts, and then by asking ourselves some questions that will help us rise above the barbs of our critics. First, ask, who is criticizing me? Strange as it may seem, the answer to that question may be nobody. We may assume that somebody else is being critical, but when we stop to think about it, we realize that the criticism is all in our own minds, a figment of our imaginations. It doesn't make sense to get upset about criticism that doesn't even exist. Sometimes we even go back to somebody who we think has criticized us and discover that we're wrong. At other times, of course, the criticism is real, but the critics are not very credible. Sometimes critics lack accurate information, so their opinions are not based on facts. At other times, the critics are expressing their own anger, frustration, and prejudice, rather than giving a considered evaluation of our actions and works. When criticism comes from those who lack accurate information or a gentle attitude, it is best not to take that criticism too seriously. This does not hide the fact, however, that some critics are right. They do have valid information, and their criticisms are worth considering. Even if criticism seems unfair, it can't be ignored when it comes from one's employer or from one's family. So this brings us to a second question. The first question, who is criticizing me? The second question, why are they criticizing me? This is not easy to answer, because it means that we must try to understand the motives of our critics. People criticize for a number of reasons, including the following. They see something wrong or incomplete, and they sincerely want to offer suggestions for improvement. They are insecure people who are always finding fault with others. Such people try to build themselves up by knocking everybody else down. Or maybe there are angry, bitter people who never see anything positive and appear to take great delight in constant fault-finding. Others are pressured people, individuals whose patience is wearing thin because they are under stress at work or home or someplace else. Because they are pressured and impatient, such people cannot tolerate imperfection or inefficiency, so they tend to explode in criticism, and the criticism may be directed at you. Sometimes highly critical remarks even burst forth from the lips of our children who are expressing frustration about something else in their lives and may not nearly be as critical of us as they sound. Then there are people with very high standards for others and sometimes for themselves. Such people are critical of those whose standards and performance are less than perfect. Well, from this list, we can conclude that criticism often comes as much from the critic's own personality and stresses as from the things being criticized. I try to remember this, especially when I'm inclined to criticize my colleagues at work or my children. Sometimes their actions are not really as bad as I imply, but I find myself criticizing because of my own tension or my own impatience. Very often, the tension comes because of what's happening within me. But then you can ask another question. Is there truth in the criticisms of me? When we are criticized, our most immediate response is to feel threatened and to get angry. Before overreacting, however, it is helpful to ask if the critic is right. Not long ago, a young man approached me following a talk that I had given to some college students. "Your talk was interesting," he stated, "but I think your ideas are irrelevant and unrealistic." As he continued talking, I could feel the muscles tense. Other people had been very complimentary of my talk, but this one man was being very critical. His criticism was an attack on my self-esteem as well as on my ideas. I was uncomfortable and uncertain how to respond, but I recognized that some of the things he was saying might very well be right. When I admitted this and decided not to be defensive, we had a lively and helpful discussion. It was even a friendly conversation. If we can get over our initial feelings of threat and anger, we can learn a lot from our critics. We need not assume that they are always right, but neither are they always wrong. As we ponder their criticisms, we must seek to find out whether the criticisms are based on facts, and then decide if the criticism is worth heeding. And this brings us to another question. The first, who is criticizing me? The second, why is someone criticizing me? The third, is there truth in this criticism of me? And fourthly, how should I respond to the criticisms of me? Well, there are several answers to this question. For one thing, we can evaluate the criticism. Most criticism has elements of truth that can be helpful and parts that can be ignored or discounted, especially when we feel that the critic does not have accurate facts. It has been suggested that when we are criticized, most of the damage comes because we let the criticism fester in our minds. We magnify the criticisms all out of proportion, focus on the negative, and fail to see the positive side of our lives. Carried away by this introspection, we become hypersensitive to criticism, defensive, and sometimes immobilized or afraid to act lest we become criticized again. Sometimes we lash back out at the individual, and this creates further interpersonal tensions. But this brings us to one other way that we can deal with criticism. We can grow from it. Although criticism can be devastating, it can also be helpful. It can point out weaknesses and alert us to things in our lives that should be changed and improved. Even when we have been angered by a critic or prevented from responding, criticism forces us to think more clearly about our actions. As a result, we may change when this seems wise, or we may conclude with greater clarity that we shouldn't change in spite of the criticism. Throughout all of this, it is helpful to maintain a sense of humor. Important to do the best we can, and crucial that we do what we think is right before God. Criticism is a part of life, but criticism can be handled. That's what my pastor told me back in those post-college days. And since that time, I've never had to worry anymore about people thinking that I was a subversive agent. We have talked about criticism because of its importance in interpersonal tensions. And at this point, I would like you to look at step 4 on your guide sheet. At that point, there are 8 questions that may help you determine both the reasons for interpersonal tension in your life and some of the ways that you can deal with the tensions in your life. These 8 questions are based on the presentation that occurred on the other side of the tape and on our comments about criticism that appeared on this side of the tape. It may be helpful for you to look up several of the Bible verses that are printed alongside of the questions. When you have finished with this tape, please complete steps 5 and 6 of the guide sheet. Then return the tape to your counselor. If you have another counseling session scheduled, be sure to take the guide sheet with you, along with any written notes that you may have jotted down while you've listened to the tape. Your counselor will be interested in looking at these notes and in discussing these different questions with you when you meet together for your next counseling session.